You know, it's like my grandma used to say, hope for the best and prepare for the worst.
Eagle residents, brace for more flooding this spring. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, highlighting innovative approaches to solving the energy crisis in rural Alaska.
The diesel is strictly standby. We were 98.5% hydropower in 2012.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at crowleyalaska.com.
The flood potential this spring has residents of Eagle on edge. The tiny Upper Yukon River community survived a devastating flood back in 2009 when a massive ice jam broke free that spring. A deluge of water wiped out the community's historic riverfront and leveled the Athabascan village. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, some residents are preparing for another major flood this spring.
Predicting breakup along the Yukon River isn't that straightforward, but current snowpack, river ice thickness, and cool temperatures are coming together in a perfect storm scenario.
We still have over a foot of snow in the woods right now.
Andy Basich homesteads roughly 12 miles downriver from the city of Eagle.
The ice was close to 5 feet thick and very solid with about 8 inches of snow on it. So all those indicators are pointing towards the possibility of a very high jamming type breakup here at our place.
Basich and Rourke nearly lost their lives 4 years ago. Along with their 25 dogs, the two were rescued by helicopter off the top of their house. This year, Basich isn't taking any chances.
I built a large raft of about 16 by 20 foot with about 12 barrels underneath of it. And we plan on putting snow machines, tools, a lot of my equipment up on top of that. We just moved our fish rack with about 1,500 fish on it. And then I'm going to start working on building an extension on our upper deck of our porch so that we can have an area to put all of our household goods.
While he finds ways to float his belongings and move them above ground, partner Kate Rourke is moving their dogs. She'll care for them in a small home the two maintain in town.
I still haven't stopped having dreams about water for 4 years, so that'll tell you the impact it had.
Before 2009, Eagle residents used to look forward to breakup. Pat Sanders has lived in Eagle for more than 30 years. In an interview last summer, she recalled a celebratory mood at the onset of warmer weather.
Store owners will leave their stores and run to the riverbank when the ice starts to move. You know, everybody's jovial and happy and noisy. And after the 2009 flood, you really didn't see people run to the riverbank when the ice started to move.
Sanders likened her feelings to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Maybe akin to that in a small way, because when you see that ice move, you see it moving and it sort of scares you now.
Anne Millard has similar feelings. She's lived along the Yukon Riverbank for 17 years. Instead of cleaning off her barbecue this spring, she's loading her personal belongings onto a school bus she can move to higher ground.
We have artwork, we have a cook stove, and we just bought a new Blaze King.
Millard says she's packing a second school bus with household items, just in case she and her husband have to live in it this summer.
You know, it's like my grandma used to say, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And so we've decided we're going to clear out everything of value in our house. And if we have a house after breakup, then we're going to paint it inside.
Other residents who live along the riverbank got a personal visit from Eagle City Mayor Don Woodruff. He's trying to make those affected by the 2009 flood aware of conditions this year. Woodruff also posted notices around town. They list items to have on hand in the event of a flood or emergency evacuation. And while he's not necessarily a betting man, he says he thinks breakup will likely happen in Eagle before June, but after May 15th. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Rural Alaska power costs are unsustainable, and this week, energy providers are gathering in Anchorage to find ways to help bring those costs down. The goal of the Alaska Rural Energy Conference is to create a forum to share ideas aimed at finding solutions for one of the biggest problems facing the state. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Everyone talks about reducing our dependence on oil, and in rural Alaska, some communities are using innovation and technology to do just that. George Hornberger is the general manager of INN Electric Co-op that serves Iliamna, New Halen, and Nondalton. His company has achieved something that was unheard of only a few years ago. It's weaned off diesel.
The diesel is strictly standby. We were 98.5% hydropower in 2012.
Hornberger says INN's facility was built in 1982, so getting to full hydro wasn't easy.
When I started managing the plant in 2009, we were still burning between 35 and 40,000 gallons of diesel fuel a year to supplement the hydro. 2012, we got down to 4,956 gallons or so of diesel fuel burned.
He says hydro and diesel systems can be integrated fairly easily, but hydro poses some unique problems like frazzle ice.
It's when the river is basically freezing from the bottom up. You have water temperature that's below freezing, microscopic crystals of ice in the water that start adhering to the bottom that makes big chunks that float up, and that was a major problem.
Hornberger credits INN's board with the foresight to take on the debt to build the hydro facilities in the first place. Harnessing river power is not a new idea, but newer innovations are wresting power from the ocean itself. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission earlier this year approved a wave power project for the city of Yakutat. Bill Staube is CEO of Resolute Marine Energy, a Boston-based company now working on that project. Staube says the wave resource is excellent in Yakutat, and he stresses that wave power is not the same as tidal energy because it is wind-driven.
As the wind blows over the surface of the ocean, it essentially induces vibrations, which is what waves really are, is vibrating water particles. The longer the distance that a wave has a chance to work uninterrupted on a water surface, the better the wave resource is likely to be. In Yakutat, those waves are essentially coming from Japan.
That's one heck of a renewable resource, but it's still in the future. On Monday, the Federal Office of Indian Energy and Policy named 5 Alaska Native villages to a program that strengthens existing renewable energy projects. They will receive up to $250,000 along with technical assistance to further community-based energy solutions. One of the winners is the native village of Congiganak. Roderick Phillip chairs Congiganak's energy board. The village is using the funds to buy thermal stoves to store energy from wind turbines.
We have 5 wind turbines and we have thermal stoves. The excess energy goes to all the thermal stoves. The thermal stoves heat homes, and when the wind's blowing, people with the thermal stoves turn their oil stoves off.
The stove's reliance on waste heat cuts way down on fuel costs, but hasn't wiped out the need for diesel just yet. But it is saving the community thousands of dollars each month. Julie Estee with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power says it will be years before diesel power is a thing of the past, so improving diesel generation to increase its efficiency now is important to Alaska.
When you're looking at fluctuating resources like wind, solar is another one, it's hard to integrate that kind of fluctuating power into a small grid. So what normally happens is a diesel generator has to keep spinning to make sure that there's not a brownout or a blackout. So the integration and making sure that you can really offset diesel by putting in a wind turbine, those are the integration issues that we're solving right now.
She says compared with the lower 48, Alaska's power grid is tiny, and innovations made here by small community projects could one day be exported to remote areas of the world which are looking to solve energy problems of their own. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Saudi Arabia's oil minister says he welcomes the United States' newfound energy bounty. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, he's not worried the kingdom will lose dominance of the oil industry.
Speaking in Washington, D.C., Ali al-Naimi scoffed at U.S. leaders who extol energy independence, especially from the Middle East, as a political goal.
This talk of ending reliance is a naive, a rather simplistic view. It seems to conflate, on the one hand, U.S. foreign policy, and on the other, U.S. energy policy.
Al-Naimi says even with the rapid technological gains that led to the current gas boom in the lower 48, the United States will not be able to isolate itself from geopolitics or global commodities markets. Shale gas accounts for less than half of U.S. gas supply, and Al-Naimi says the U.S. bought more Saudi oil in 2012 than any year before.
Just as I didn't buy into the peak oil theories, I do not go along with the opinion that increasing U.S. liquid production means the United States could and should detach itself from international affairs.
That's especially true considering there are about a dozen export permits for liquefied natural gas pending before the federal government. Some 70% of Saudi exports go to Asian markets, the same markets that Alaska one day hopes to export its own LNG to. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new film digs into the life of former Governor Wally Hickel.
We try to show the originality of the man, the risk taker that he was.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The city of Anchorage has rejected a second version of an application to hold a referendum to repeal a new ordinance that limits unions. And as KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports, it looks like whether the referendum goes forward will be decided in court.
The clerk's office rejected the latest referendum application because attorneys say the ordinance is administrative rather than legislative, so it can't be reversed by a referendum. Andy Holloman with the Anchorage Education Association was a sponsor of the application. He disagrees with the city's decision.
The next step now is to go to courts and ask them to rule on it.
The group's second attempt at a referendum cleaned up some technical problems with the first application. Holloman says union leaders will be asking the court for expedited consideration and for the law to be suspended. But he says their primary goal is to bring the law before the people of Anchorage for a vote.
Real bargaining needs to be balanced between both parties. And essentially, we feel that what Dan Sullivan did prior to starting bargaining is he went in and legislated a lot of what he wanted to see happen at the bargaining table.
Attorneys working for the municipality on behalf of the Sullivan administration maintain the referendum can't legally go forward. The ordinance impacts around 2,200 municipal employees. It limits pay, benefits, mediation, and eliminates the option of a strike. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The colorful and often controversial former governor, the late Wally Hickel, is the subject of a new film entitled Alaska, the World, and Wally Hickel. Consulting producer Paul Brown says the film covers everything from Hickel's resolve to rebuild downtown Anchorage after the devastating 1964 earthquake to his firing by President Richard Nixon when he served as Interior Secretary and disagreed with Nixon over the war in Vietnam. The former governor was around 78 years old when Brown met him. He says Hickel was still youthful in his vision.
He was clearly, by this time in his life, more than taken with the idea of the commons in the world and how we globally use resources to benefit all people, not just the few. But that was the beginning. So when I left that conversation and I left Alaska and I went back to New York, I went looking on the internet and there were a few things, but not a lot. And so I came back the following year and went to the next Alaska Dialogue. And I remember saying to Hickel, Governor, agree with you or disagree with you, more needs to be known about your life and about the way you see the world.
What do you try to capture in an hour? Because Governor Hickel, former Governor Hickel's actions in the state were broad. He did a lot of things personally also, building the Captain Cook. What did you try to focus in on?
We try to show the originality of the man, the risk taker that he was. As an example, you mentioned the Captain Cook. As many people in Anchorage know, that after the 1964 earthquake, many people gave up on downtown, felt that we had to relocate to Midtown. And Hickel, in very short order, decided to build the Captain Cook downtown. We deal substantially, I think, with the time that Hickel was Secretary of the Interior in 1969 and 70. Specifically, Hickel standing up to Nixon when he felt that the president was very much off course on the war, particularly the invasion of Cambodia. And most important, Hickel felt that Nixon and especially Vice President Agnew were completely missing when it came to listening to younger people and what younger people had to say and contribute to our country.
Some of his ideas, the water pipeline from Southeast Alaska to California, the underground tunnel rail line idea to Siberia, at the time seemed outrageous. In retrospect, now looking at those ideas today, what do you think they say about Wally Hickel?
I first of all think that they underscore the visionary that he was, but they also tell you something, I think, about his ethics or his morality. I mean, one of the things that I find remarkable about him is that he would question war. Why war? Why not big projects? Shouldn't civilization have some fun and do things that are useful? He also felt that there was, as he said many times, no legitimate reason for poverty in the world. He was not willing to accept that the poor will always be with us. He was looking for the ways that development could work with environmentalism. He felt that development done well had lifted millions of people around the world out of poverty, and that the job wasn't finished.
Wally Hickel's wife, Irma Lee, they were more than just husband and wife. They were partners in a much broader sense. How important do you see her role in his life as helping him achieve some of the great successes that he did?
One of the things that I noticed when we researched for the film was that if you look at the critical decisions that Hickel had to make in his life, you can almost always find Irma Lee there encouraging him to take the risk if it's the right thing to do. When Wally Hickel was disgusted by a cabinet meeting where he learned about the invasion of Cambodia that President Nixon told the cabinet, he was shaken. He didn't think this was the person that he had campaigned for. And he came home and he shared that with Irma Lee Hickel, and she was equally disturbed, but not, gee whiz, Wally, you have to be quiet about it. Not, that wasn't Irma Lee. She was there with him when he began to think, well, now, what am I going to do about it?
Unusual, right? Even past his life here on the planet. Do you know of anyone else that was reported to be buried standing up in a fighter's stance?
I don't. Bishop Hurley, who presided said that he hadn't known of anybody else who was buried standing up, but that was, you know, that was typical Hickel. It was going to do it his way.
Paul Brown is the consulting producer for the film Alaska, the World, and Wally Hickel. The film premieres in Anchorage on Thursday evening, May 2nd, at a public event at the Captain Cook Hotel, and on Alaska Public Television on May 9th. More information is at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Fairbanks Public Gas Utility has applied to the state for a service area. It's an initial step for the entity created by the North Star Borough Assembly last fall. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Interior Alaska Natural Gas Utility was set up to push a plan to process and truck in gas from the North Slope. Board Chair Bob Shefchik says a service application to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska targets neighborhoods in and around Fairbanks.
The North Pole, Badger, Farmers Loop, and Chena Ridge areas, because they're the less dense areas that are not being served by the current gas supplier, Fairbanks Natural Gas, and in particular North Pole was selected because of the combination of density and poor air quality.
Fairbanks Natural Gas has applied to expand into the same areas. Shefchik says there's potential for the borough-created utility to work with the private company.
FNG has expressed an interest in being our partner as well as an interest in having the service area for themselves. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska will look at both, and we'll look at both the FNG's area and how many residents are currently being served in that, as well as both of our ability and willingness to perform. And so across the summer, there'll be a hearing and they'll make a determination based on what they hear.
Shefchik says the Interior Natural Gas Utility may qualify as a political subdivision of government and be exempt from economic regulation.
The way the state law works is the Interior Gas Utility could ask to be exempted from rate regulation. Because of the newness of our nature and RCA's interest in the area in general, we have voluntarily agreed to have our application be considered for rate regulation.
Public comment on the service area application is being accepted by the RCA through May 20th. Local distribution is one piece of the North Slope to Fairbanks gas trucking project. The state is considering applications from Fairbanks Natural Gas and Golden Valley Electric for funding to build and operate a gas processing plant and truck gas south. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The spring whaling season is underway on Alaska's North Slope. The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission reports St. Lawrence Island whaling crews are having success with 4 bowheads landed by Savunga hunters and 2 for gamble. Whalers on the mainland coast are ready and waiting. Barrow elder Walter Ockpick isn't participating in the hunt this year, but he's likely following it closely. Last summer, he spoke with reporter Ann Hillman for part of our series on Alaska culture and described just what it takes to land a whale.
We wait for the whale to come to us. We don't chase it. We don't look for it. We wait for it to come to us, to the boat. We could wait maybe 2 weeks. We could wait one day. We could wait a few hours. It depends. So the whaling captains tells us or teach us where to sit in a boat if the whale comes up. You be in the back. You steer the boat. You sit right here by the gun. It's different roles. But I always try to sit behind the float, because the harpooner strikes it and you got to be quick to put the float over the side. If you don't, that whale's gonna, when it dives, that float could be, if it's in the boat, it's gonna tip it over. We gotta get away from the whale after we strike. Cause just in case, you gotta watch out for the flippers. If you're too close to the hunt, right after you harpoon the whale, the flipper might come up and start going like that and might hit the boat. So we gotta get away from there. You gotta let go of the float, let go of everything, and just wait for it. And they'll come back up. The float will come back up, and that's where the whale is. You gotta aim for the heart or the backbone or the brain. Okay. Those are the kill zones, the heart, the backbone. You break the backbone, it's not ever gonna dive down or anything. It's just gonna be on the water. It's just gonna be on top of the water. I mean, not top, but a wounded whale will stay under water half hour or more. But the whale gotta come up every 20 minutes or so to breathe. So after you strike, you just gotta wait around. You know it's gonna come back up, not unless it goes under the ice. If it don't go under the ice, you know it's gonna come up anywhere. So you just gotta look for it. You just gotta wait. It's just patience. It takes patience to go whaling, to be a whaler. Yeah, you gotta drag it to the edge of the ice where you're gonna pull it up. It's come on power. We don't use machines, we use block and tackle. It could take 40, 50 people, maybe sometime more, to pull up a whale by manpower.
Walter Ockpick of Barrow spoke with Ann Hillman last summer. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Ann Hillman in Barrow. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Start a second career. Earn a Master's of Arts in Teaching degree from the University of Alaska Southeast, from home or on campus. Registration information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.